This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. After entering Sudan to report on Darfur, journalist Paul Salopek was captured by pro-government guerrillas, traded to the military, imprisoned, and charged with being a spy. Having two Pulitzer Prizes to his name was irrelevant to the government authorities in Sudan. Salopek was released 5 weeks later after American journalists and elected officials intervened on his behalf. Salopek is the Africa correspondent for the Chicago Tribune, and at the time of his capture, in August 2006, he was on assignment for National Geographic. Imprisonment prevented him from completing research on the story he was writing about the Sahel, a belt of semi-arid grassland in Africa stretching over about 2,500 miles, which he describes as home to 50 million of the world's poorest, most disempowered people. But Salopek later returned to the Sahel to complete his research. His article about the Sahel and his imprisonment is the cover story of this month's National Geographic. Paul Salopek, welcome to Fresh Air. Paul, what was the story you were expecting to write about the Sahel?
I was asked to do a transect of this geographic region across northern Africa and basically do a story about the geography, culture, and politics of what is a big geographic and cultural transition zone. So it was going to be a piece that did incorporate a bit about conflicts between different cultures there, but was also going to focus on geography, on biology, just sort of a usual National Geographic in-depth piece on a certain part of the world.
And you got a lot of that into your article, but a lot of the article, of course, is your story of being kidnapped and imprisoned. You were first arrested by people in a militia in the border between Chad and Sudan, which you describe as a no man's land, a no-go zone. Would you just describe that area in which you were, I don't know what to call it, kidnapped, detained, arrested? What word would you use?
You could use any of those, ambushed even. I think it would look a lot like the American Southwest, if people are familiar perhaps with the Mojave Desert of California or the deserts of Arizona, very dry, scrubby landscape with parched mountains in the distance. And this is a part of Africa where borders are not delineated. The countries are enormous. The borders were drawn by colonial rulers a long time ago. And these are very poor countries that don't have the wherewithal to patrol their borders, much less erect barriers to mark them. So it's an open space, an open desert space between one of the hottest wars in Africa today, that being Western Sudan, and a country that is nominally at peace, Chad, that has its own internal problems. But you could be driving in a Land Rover or a Land Cruiser across this landscape, not really knowing if you're crossing borders at all.
How did you get kidnapped?
We had done interviews. When I say we, I mean my translator, Daoud Hari, and my driver, Idris Anu, at a series of refugee camps on the Chadian side. There are hundreds of thousands of Darfurians who are living in camps, UN-funded camps there. And we heard from the people who had walked away from the war zone to the safety of Chad that a few people were actually moving back into the war zone because they didn't like living in the camps. They found the life restrictive. They felt they were being harassed by surrounding ethnic groups. And this was a small window in time when a peace deal had been signed and there was a little bit of hope that maybe peace would be coming to Darfur. So this seemed like a positive twist to an otherwise very dreary story. And after doing a good deal of checking on the security situation with NGOs, with local security forces, with journalists who had traversed that area just a day or two before, we decided to go across and find some of these people who were resettling their destroyed villages on the Sudanese side of the border.
So had you crossed into Sudan yet when you were arrested?
Yes, we did. We had driven across, again, what was a dry gulch, and that was pointed out to me as being the border. And about 2 hours in, we were accosted by this unit of guerrillas who had allied themselves very recently with the central government in Khartoum.
Describe the guys who kidnapped you.
They were, as many soldiers in the wars in this part of Africa, they were extremely young. Some would have qualified as child soldiers. Young men in their teens, some even as young as their mid-teens, wearing motley scraps of uniform, carrying a motley array of weaponry, from old Kalashnikovs to M14 rifles. Some of them were draped in these small black leather pouches, which from a distance might look like dried fruit or perhaps even ammunition pouches, but they were Quranic amulets to protect them against bullets. These guys rose out of the grass alongside the road, detained us, and I knew from the expression of my interpreter, Daoud, when he returned to the car, that we were definitely in trouble. You can often talk your way through these kind of situations in war zones in Africa, but this I knew was going to be a difficult one.
How did you know that?
After about 15 minutes, after they took away our equipment, took away our satellite phones, and whispering with Daoud about what they were saying, signs were turning against us that they would be releasing us anytime soon.
Did you try to imagine what was going in the mind of these teenagers with guns, thinking if there was any way to convince them not to kill you?
Yeah, generally, you as a war correspondent, you try to do exactly what you're saying. You try to see it from their point of view. You try to be friendly with them. You offer them cigarettes, the standard etiquette in war zones around the world with foot soldiers. You talk to them about where they're from. You make small talk. You explain what you're doing. But in very remote wars, such as the one in Darfur, where not too many journalists actually penetrate, I might have been the first Western journalist some of these young kids had seen. There's confusion about what journalism is. What does a reporter do? Are you an NGO? Are you with the UN? Why have you come all this way to simply scribble in your notebook?
Are you a spy?
Are you a spy? That one comes up generally at the commander level, not so much the foot soldiers, but the next level up. That's one of the first questions. And of course, that's what the rap that we ended up being charged with when we were detained by Sudanese army forces.
You had a couple of things going against you. You were carrying two passports, but no visa. Why did you have two passports?
This is a common practice for many foreign correspondents, not just conflict reporters. The banal reason is sometimes you're applying for visas at multiple embassies, so you need to have your passports going around between different consulates. The other is that when you cover both sides of a war, as correspondents often do these days, I distinctly remember covering the Ethiopian-Eritrean war and jumping from one side of the battlefield to the other, and basically looking across to where I'd just been under shell fire from the Ethiopians. You need two passports because obviously the host government doesn't like to see the stamp of its enemy in your passport. So this is standard practice.
So did the militia guys who kidnapped you, did they really want your car? Did they want your Toyota?
Yeah, I think, of course, I think that's a factor as well. When a war goes on long enough, especially a bush war, and in the case of Darfur is a classic example, lines of discipline start breaking down, poverty gets so grinding, the conditions of life get so horrible that there's a tendency for what are already sort of loosely governed militias with very weak command and control, that they break down, especially at the fringes, and often turn into simple bandits. And if you're taking a canoe through the Congo or if you're covering the war in Darfur, it's a very fine distinction between whether the guys that are holding you are in it for what they can rob from you or if they're in it for ideological reasons. Often they combine both and have the best of both worlds.
And in your case?
I think it was that. I think it was a bit of opportunism. I think it was the timing of our capture that made the biggest difference of all. Again, this was at a time in the history of this particular war when the rebel groups, which had been only nominally unified in the past against what they are saying is repression by the central government, had started squabbling among themselves, and Khartoum had managed to drive a wedge into them with this peace deal to break away chunks of them, and so they would become de facto militias for the government. And all this was happening just as we entered the war zone. And so it was something that was brand new. And even though our information was maybe from colleagues was only a day or two old, that would prove to be, in this case, too old. Things were changing so quickly.
If you're just joining us, my guest is journalist Paul Salopek. He's a two-time Pulitzer Prize winner, and he has the cover story in the April edition of National Geographic, and it's about the 34 days he spent in prison in Darfur beginning August 6, 2006, after being captured by militia, then traded to the Sudanese military. The article is also about the things that were going on around him in the Sahel, which is the 2,400-mile area of land across Africa that separates the Sahara Desert from more fertile territory. On the third day of your captivity in Darfur, the gunman who had arrested you traded you, your translator and your driver, to the Sudanese army for a box of uniforms. Why did the Sudanese army want you? Of what value were you to them?
In retrospect, I think it was seen by hardliners in the regime, in the military, in the military intelligence, as a propaganda coup. This was at a time of year when we were captured, when they were planning to unleash a major offensive against the rebels, which, as it turns out, flopped. So they were trying, in my analysis, to basically capture a high-profile journalist and make an example of him or her to try to scare other reporters from entering the side door into the conflict from Chad. It's very difficult to get permission to go into Darfur from the Sudanese side of the war, the government side. Visas do come, but they come at the pace of a trickle. And when you do enter, you need added paperwork to get into Darfur itself. You need to check in with central intelligence types. They keep tabs on you. They discourage sources from talking to you as a means of information management. So they, I think, just got tired of dozens and dozens of Western journalists covering the conflict from the Chadian side, going into what is essentially this no man's land, this shifting liberated zone where the rebels have nominal control when bandits or government units aren't patrolling. So a show trial, I think, is what they had in mind.
Among the things that you were accused with was spying. And for a government like the government in Sudan, is spying and journalism more or less the same thing? Because they don't want the world knowing what they're doing. So if you're reporting on it, that's not good for them.
That is. And I think a lot of these governments have inherited pretty draconian media laws from their old colonial governments. So the kernel for this kind of suspicion, the kernel for the legal framework in a place like Sudan to try a journalist for spying, would actually probably go back to the British, who instituted those laws to control nationalist sentiment way back, you know, a few generations back. So that's one of the ironies of these kind of occurrences, not just in Sudan, but elsewhere in Africa and in formerly colonial governed areas of South Asia as well. These draconian press laws have their origins in colonial laws. As it is, I mean, I have to point out that this is something that my Sudanese colleagues face all the time, and they're constantly in and out of jail multiple times for the work they do, whether it's, breaching so-called government secrets, or there's a Government Secrecy Act, or formally being charged with espionage. There's even an added wrinkle in Sudan. There's something called intentional espionage and unintentional espionage. The intentional espionage I sort of get. What unintentional espionage is, which we were also charged with, has never been really well explained to me, even by our lawyers. I think it's basically having documents in your hand or having knowledge in your head that you're not supposed to, no matter how you got a hold of it.
Wow, how do you argue against that? Yeah, that you have knowledge in your head that you're not supposed to have.
I think the point is that you can't. There are all these layers of how repressive regimes cloak themselves. They can use extrajudicial means, which is brutality or outright violence, or they can use quasi-legal means, laws that they have in the books they've had in for years. But yeah, it would have been an interesting, I'm glad we never came to a trial, but had it come to a trial, it would have been an interesting display of legal logic to see how unintentional espionage could be laid on us.
So you were taken to a secret prison. There's so many of these secret prisons in Sudan. There's a name for them, a ghost house. Would you describe the secret prison, the ghost house that you were in?
We arrived just as it was getting dark. We were taken by helicopter to the provincial capital of North Darfur, a town called El Fasher, and the sun was just setting. They put us into a vehicle that had Sudanese government humanitarian markings on it, and then drove us, it had tinted windows so we couldn't see out, into what appeared to be a walled compound. I later discovered, once we were released, that it was in the middle of a military base, and it was a ghost house or secret prison where they took political prisoners for interrogations. A sandy compound, a high mud brick wall painted yellow that you couldn't see over, sentries in the corners, a cell block that probably dated back to British colonial times, in a state of disarray, disrepair. And at one point when I thought I was being smart, I was trying to write little rescue messages on scraps of cigarette paper and flicking them over the wall, which turned out to be hilarious because they were probably bouncing off the heads of Sudanese soldiers, which I would have been funny to have somebody actually open one of them and read them. So we didn't know where we were. I was familiar with the notion of a ghost house from previous reporting trips into Sudan. Sudanese opposition politicians, activists, often are incarcerated in ghost houses. Their families can't find them. They just disappear off the face of the earth. Eventually, I think most of them resurface in court. Some never do.
My guest is Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Paul Salopek. He wrote the cover story of this month's National Geographic. It's about being captured and imprisoned while reporting on Darfur. You decided to go on a hunger strike. Why?
Two reasons. The main one was to be reunited with my translator and driver because I did not know the conditions that they were being held in. I was held in isolation for 9 days at this ghost house. And so I kept demanding to be reunited, and they refused, so I stopped eating. The second reason I decided to stop eating was because they refused to give us access to our embassy in Khartoum, which is against international law. If you get into trouble, if you get put in jail, they're supposed to notify your embassy with a certain number of hours or days. And they clearly were holding us in a bubble, and that was very dangerous because in a place like Darfur, it would be very easy to claim that they just find your body out in the desert later. So the longer that the days dragged on, the more improbable to my mind it seemed that they would actually release us because it would be increasingly embarrassing for them to have held us for so long. So I launched this hunger strike that pointed out to be fruitless.
Did they even know what the concept of a hunger strike was?
They, at the beginning, were a bit puzzled as to why I wasn't eating. Even throughout, the ordinary guards didn't seem terribly concerned. I think this is a hard part of the world where people go without eating normally in the normal course of
exactly.
life.
People are starving to death and you're in a hunger
exactly.
strike.
Exactly. So I think maybe the moral high ground that I was trying to claim proved a bit confusing to them, but the notion finally trickled high enough up in the chain of command that I got a message down saying, you continue to do this and we'll force feed you with a tube.
Yes, and the message included this. It said that they'd force feed you through a tube like the Americans do at Guantanamo.
That's correct.
And yeah. I'm wondering what went through your mind knowing that of the few things the people imprisoning you knew about America, they'd heard that detainees were force-fed at Gitmo.
On the rougher corners of the world where extrajudicial treatment, harsh treatment of prisoners is a norm, this is well known. I mean, maybe 30 or 40 years ago, Elvis and his music might have been one of the things people associate with the United States. But today, Guantanamo resonates very strongly. And I immediately became concerned because there are a few Sudanese, to my knowledge, being held at Guantanamo still, including one journalist. So at that point, I saw it was pretty hopeless, and I also wanted to keep my strength up, to have the strength in my upper body to be able to spring over the wall if I needed to in an emergency. So I decided to start eating on the ninth day.
Were you interrogated, and if so, what were the questions like?
There were multiple interrogations, and it was the questioning was about the documents that I had on me, about my work. In today's world, even in a ramshackle secret police outpost in the middle of the Darfurian desert, they have internet. So they were able to Google me and see the work that I'd done in the past, confronted me with the work that I've done in the past, particularly in Sudan, and making repeated accusations of me being a spy, essentially trying to scare me. So it was a lot of multiple questions. I'm being asked 50 times in a row, is that you in your passport photo? It doesn't look like you. So mind games, basically, to try to wear you down.
Paul Salopek will be back in the second half of the show. His article about the Sahel region of Africa and his imprisonment in Darfur is the cover story of this month's National Geographic. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Let's get back to our interview with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Paul Salopek about his capture and imprisonment in Darfur while on assignment for National Geographic in August 2006. He was imprisoned for 34 days. He later returned to the Sahel region of Africa to finish his research. His article about his imprisonment and the Sahel is the cover story of this month's National Geographic. You were in, I think, three different jails during the course of your imprisonment. And in the third jail you were in Sudan, you were forced to watch a flogging with an oxhide whip. You saw an adulterer get 100 lashes. What did you learn from watching the flogging?
It was one of several, actually. We also saw men flogged for drinking alcohol. They got 25 lashes. Women were also flogged for brewing alcohol. We were not privy to that because they did that in a section of the prison that was reserved for women. But they actually would bring in women with children, very small children, and flog them, I presume in front of their children. I'm not sure. What I learned was just the amazing human capacity for pain and the toughness and the dignity of the people being flogged. It was also an interesting, for me, interaction between captor and captive. This form of torture is of course, horrific to witness, even as a bystander. Even, you know, it's not happening to you, but you're standing a few yards away. But there was this strange intimacy between the man doing the flogging and the man receiving the punishment, the main whip man, Corporal Sala. In the end, when I got to know him, strangely was able in his heart and mind to divide his life between the times when he was, you know, peeling the skin off somebody's back and being a nice guy who wanted to be a doctor studying microbiology at night.
So the whip man, Corporal Sala, later called you after you were freed. He wanted your help in getting him a visa so he could get out of the country, so he could get out of Sudan. What did you tell him?
Yeah, I mean, the world is a strange place, isn't it? And maybe also an indication that things are not all bad. 2 months after I was released, I was doing my laundry at home, and the phone rang, and my wife handed me the phone. And here was this familiar voice coming across the wires. Corporal Sala was calling to check on me to see how my health was, probably using a phone in a police station in Khartoum without his superior's permission, because it, I imagine, would be an expensive phone call. But towards the end, it became clear that the conversation drifted towards me helping him with the visa lottery to come to America. I told him what I knew. I hold nothing against Corporal Sala. Corporal Sala is a man who is trapped in his head, in his heart, in a time and a place that I can't judge him negatively, because I know too much about what life is like in that part of Africa, in the Sahel. It's hard. So I told him, I said, go to the consulate and good luck. Just don't, you know, what I didn't tell him is he probably wanted to omit some things from his curriculum vitae.
Like being the whip man.
Like being the whip man at the Alfasher prison.
Eventually, your newspaper, the Chicago Tribune, your magazine, the National Geographic, for whom you were on assignment, found out that you were being detained, and they did their best to get you out. Governor Bill Richardson of New Mexico, where you lived, went to bat for you and even went to negotiate with the president of Sudan. Did he actually fly to Africa?
Yes, Governor Richardson, my editor at the Tribune, Anne-Marie Lipinski, my editor at National Geographic, Chris Johns, all flew to Khartoum to pick me up. You can imagine the shock this was for all three of us in jail, because we are locked in a bubble most of the time. Only towards the very end did we have access to phone calls. So we'll be in our cells, you know, our scalps are flaking, we're feeding some of our scalp to the ants for entertainment, to discover after the fact that this amazing effort had been mobilized on our behalf was amazingly heartening.
So you finally got out after 34 days in Sudan. When did you know, I'm really getting out? When did you allow yourself to think, this is really going to happen?
When I saw the rescue party, as it were, comprised of my editors and Bill Richardson in El Fasher. Once they let us through the gate of the prison yard at the courthouse, and there were shiny new SUVs waiting outside, engines idling, I knew that it would be very difficult for them to turn us back at this point. Although we did have a close call. I mean, there were some last-minute hitches, and the governor of that province, that state of Darfur, was making trouble, making delays. So it was dicey up to the very end, but at that point I knew it would be too embarrassing for them to send us back.
Okay, it was August in 2006 when you were kidnapped, arrested, detained. You said all of those words are fine.
Yeah.
And your story in National Geographic, the story that you were doing the reporting for when you were arrested, has just been published in the National
Right.
Geographic. After getting released from this hellish experience, you went back to the Sahel in Africa to finish your reporting, which amazes me, because I can tell you, if this had happened to me, which it never would have, because I'd never be in your circumstance in the first place, but if it had happened to me, I'd never go back. I mean, you were charged with a 22-year crime. You could have been arrested for 22 years. You could have been killed. You were really lucky to get out. Why did you go back?
Multiple reasons, and I think it's partly due to my background, but also to the importance of the story. We haven't talked much about the Sahel at large, but I had a commitment to the story. That's where 50 million people live, some of them in the most dire circumstances imaginable. So I had a commitment to the story itself, to get the story of the Sahel out, of the people of the Sahel. That's one thing. The second reason is, if I didn't go back, the people who captured us and were attempting to put on a show trial with us would, in essence, have won. They would have discouraged foreign reporters from covering this part of the world, Darfur in particular. But again, I like to think of the whole region, because a lot of the problems that are accentuated to a horrific degree in Darfur exist throughout a much larger area of Africa. They just don't get the attention. So I felt I didn't want to give them the power to basically knock us out of the picture. I went back with a dual sense of mission. One, to fulfill my mission as a journalist. Two, to not let the guys who threw us in jail win.
You know, in your cover story in the National Geographic, you tell not only the story of you, your translator and driver, who were imprisoned for 34 days in Sudan. You report on a lot of the people who you met in the Sahel in Africa and the conditions that they're living and dying under. And in Chad, you met George Bush's father. And I read that and I thought, what? He met George Bush's father in Chad? And of course, George Bush is just the name of the son. He's from Chad. He's not the American George Bush. Why did the father name his son George Bush? And which of the two Bushes did he name him after?
He named him after the current president, who is viewed favorably among the Darfurian refugees in Chad, at least some of them, for trying to stand up to the Khartoum regime. So George Bush is popular among some circles of Darfuris as being one of the few American presidents who are attempting to engage. Also, it's a reflection of the larger ideological battle around the world between the West and political Islam or extremist religious ideologies. And the irony of that whole section in the story, what struck me, which I tried to get across to readers, is here you have an individual from one of the most complicated parts of the world, where lines of identity are braided through every person that you would never expect to find. Here's a guy who is identifying himself as ethnically African, a dark-complected gentleman who is a farmer and part of the ethnic groups that are being victimized by ethnic Arab militias, the notorious Janjaweed, who themselves are being armed by an ethnic Arab-dominated country, Sudan. And yet, he behaves like an Arab himself. He wears an Arab jellabia, a long gown. He drinks sweetened tea the way Arabs do. He speaks Arabic. He prays toward Mecca. The point of that passage was saying, here is the conundrum that anybody faces coming from the outside, trying to dissect the many different lines that comprise this amazing 2,500-mile-long frontier called the Sahel. Multiple lines of identity that shift. And this man, at this time in his life, was being victimized by an ethnic Arab regime. And therefore, he named his son after what, around large chunks of the world views as the largest anti-Islamic fighter, as it were, whether it's an accurate portrayal or not, and that's George Bush. So he named his son George Bush, and here was this chubby little toddler who was sitting in this plot of sand in the deserts of Darfur, and Darfurian refugees in tents around him would be calling out, "Hey, Bush, hey, Bush," and he would wave back. He was very popular.
My guest is Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Paul Salopek. He wrote the cover story of this month's National Geographic. It's about his imprisonment in Darfur and about the Sahel region of Africa. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Paul Salopek. He wrote the cover story of this month's National Geographic, which is about being captured and imprisoned while reporting on Darfur. Your article doesn't end with you getting out of prison in Sudan. It ends with how people from the Sahel in Africa try to get out and get to another country where they might be in less danger and get some work. And you write about the captain of a boat that illegally ferried people out of Africa. Tell us a little bit about the boat and the people who tried to get on it.
Yeah, there's a mass migration of Africans out of Africa. Just in the analogy for North America would be Latin Americans or Mexicans coming north across the Rio Grande to seek a better life. There's that similar south-to-north migration from Africa to Europe, Africa to the Middle East. Only you would have to magnify the suffering of the migrants manyfold over, because the poorest of the poor in the Sahel are many, many orders of magnitude poorer than the poorest Mexican or the poorest Latin American. So these people sell whatever they have, whether it's a sewing machine, an old bicycle. If it's a little shack on a sandy plot in a slum, they'll sell that. Every worldly possession, they'll borrow from their cousins and families to scrape enough together. And at the time that I did the story, it was about $700 to $900 for 12 inches of plank seating on an open boat that would make a passage from the west coast of Africa. Senegal was a point of departure that was popular when I was there, to the outlying outposts of Fortress Europe, in this case, the Canary Islands. And it was a harsh trip, a trip in which many people die. Many thousands of people have died over the past decade making such trips. And success of survival is not great. It's good enough that if you're desperate, you'll go, but it's not great. It's far, far more dangerous than sneaking across our borders in North America. So I found a guy in a port called St. Louis, north of Dakar, the capital of Senegal, who was willing to talk to me at his beach hut the day before he was scheduled to take a boatload of people on this very perilous ocean journey in what is essentially an open canoe with an outboard motor. And they pack them. They're about maybe 60 feet long, and they pack them with 100 or more people, gunwale to gunwale. I mean, it's a beehive. And you have maybe a foot of freeboard, and that's the part of the boat that sticks up out of the waves, but separating you and the ocean. And this half-wallowing boat would set off across the Atlantic. The smuggler, in this case a chap named Didier, would use a GPS to find his way hundreds and hundreds of nautical miles across the open sea to these islands controlled by Spain. The title of my piece for the magazine is Lost in the Sahel, and that has a double meaning. I mean, it's about being, you know, for a while literally lost in Darfur, not knowing where I was and shuttling between prisons. But it also has the meaning of having lost something in the Sahel. I have no illusions that I'm probably not the same person I was.
What do you think you lost?
Probably a sense of invincibility that we as journalists try to carry around to do our jobs. And I think that's a healthy thing to maybe jettison for one's survival.
You've been a foreign correspondent for 15 years. You've been covering wars for a long time. You've said there used to be an implicit deal with combatants. The journalist tells their side of story if the combatants don't kill the journalist. You say that doesn't really exist anymore. Journalists have become targets in a way that they weren't when you started covering wars. What's changed, and why do you think it's changed?
I think the nature of warfare itself has changed. Big set-piece battles between uniformed armies has become essentially the exception, hasn't it? The invasion of Iraq was almost a throwback war, where you had uniformed armies squaring off against each other, at least at the beginning. And it evolved very quickly, into the latest form of warfare, which some military academics call fourth-generation warfare, which means that every single human being walking the planet is the battlefield. So set lines with their front lines, with their trenches, where you can get a laissez-passe, a safe passage between enemy armies, etc., that almost seems quaint. So what my predecessors had to deal with, say, during the Second World War, is something that just no longer holds today. You enter as a journalist into the modern war where there is no front line, often characterized as brushfire wars, guerrilla wars, insurgencies. You immerse yourself in all the dangers of a combatant, and your little press pass, this little thing that covers your heart and your breast pocket, has become more than ever just a slip of paper and not a shield. So we have become, in fact, targets. For my career, it really started in the Balkans. It started before then, I think, even in Vietnam. But for me, the Balkan Wars was the seminal war where these nice, tidy lines about civilized behavior vis-a-vis reporters, the media, it just started breaking down in a big way. A lot of colleagues were killed in the Balkans.
You've been covering constant ethnic wars and civil wars through Africa. I want to give our listeners a sense of three headlines from your articles within the course of 1 month. October 28, 2007, headline, Freedom of Speech Can Kill You. In Mogadishu, Tribune correspondent Paul Salopek encounters reporters who are afraid to even go outside, with good reasons. And then in the article, you describe how the subject of your story was murdered by the time you published it. The journalist who you're writing about was murdered by the time you went to press. November 14th, just a couple of weeks later, 2007, headline, Somalis retreat from horrors of war into mental illness. A couple of weeks after that, November 25th, headline, Under the Volcano, a Congolese frontier town's main industry, survival. Okay, so that's three stories in a month, two different countries. How do you even keep track of who's killing who? And why?
Well, I don't look at stories that way. I don't approach them in a way where I have to look. Let me rephrase this. War is war. The tactics stay the same through the centuries. They've changed a bit. Uniforms change. The ideologies change. But the face of war remains the same. And it's lately, in the course of our lifetimes, it's become civilian populations that have borne the brunt of warfare. And that is more the way I look at it. It's very easy to get briefed, to go do your interviews before you enter a war zone to find out who's killing who and why. The more difficult part is bringing to life the human face of warfare over and over again without turning readers off, without making readers' eyes glaze over, without their hearts hardening. And I still, if I told you that I had a formula for how to do this, I'd be lying. I still struggle with it. I joke with a couple colleagues that I don't really consider myself a conflict or war reporter. I consider myself more a love reporter. I just look for love in all the wrong places. There are wonderful stories about human survival, about grit, about bravery, about love that you find on a battlefield. And in a sense, I mean, I have to cop to the accusation here that that's actually the easy part way to find it, because it's so black and white, right? When you're surrounded by so much darkness, when people behave well, it shines like a beam of white light. It's a little more difficult to do in ordinary life, and that's maybe where the real challenge is. Maybe I'm copying to go to the easy route where the contrasts are greater.
Well, you do an incredible job of reporting and writing. I want to thank you so much for talking with us. Thank you so much, Paul Salopek.
Appreciate it. Thank you for inviting me.
Paul Salopek wrote the cover story of this month's National Geographic. It's about the Sahel region of Africa and his imprisonment in Darfur. He spoke to us from a studio in Johannesburg. He's the Africa correspondent for the Chicago Tribune. You can find a link to Salopek's National Geographic article on our website, freshair.npr.org, where you can also download podcasts of our show. This is Fresh Air. I'm so grateful to our guests, like Paul Salopek, for the work they do and for their willingness to share their stories with us. At a time when the media world is in constant flux and many publications are cutting back or folding, I urge you not to take public radio for granted. Please call with a pledge. Thank you so much. The Waco Brothers is a band begun in the mid-1990s by John Langford. This Welshman, transplanted to Chicago, was a key member of the British punk band The Meekons and has developed an interest in American country music from the 50s and 60s. The band has released more than half a dozen studio recordings, but the new Waco Brothers album captures them on stage. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review.
Here's a song by the Waco Brothers. It's called Waco Express.
John Langford sings in his Welsh twang on that song that the Waco brothers believe, quote, nobody wants to go out on a limb these days. He couches the composition as a love song, singing that the reason you don't tell me you love me is you're scared. But the song is really a metaphor for Langford's own great love, country music, which he firmly believes has been scared into timidity and blandness by the Nashville music industry establishment. It is the Waco Brothers' mission to bring blood, sweat, and tears back into country music.
From the country to the town, police and buses held us down. They had to stop when the ground was laid, but it's tough by the Indian Bay. Don't think the king woke up one morning, said all the people should be better paid. No. Things were bad, but things got changed. Pretty tough by the Indian Bay.
There are no Blood Brothers in the Waco Brothers. Instead, there are former members of British acts such as the Meekons, Jesus Jones, and Graham Parker's old backup band, The Rumor. The so-called token American is guitarist Dino Schlabowski. They have a rather romantic view of country music. I doubt that, this side of Merle Haggard, any American country act has written a furious hymn to organized labor like the song I just played called Plenty Tough and Union Made. But that's part of John Langford's vision. This is country music as it should be written and played, with a long memory for roadhouse honky-tonks rather than TV-ready music videos. He's written a blunt song about the commercialization of country that's a lot more fun than most angry broadsides. I'll let Langford introduce it.
This song is about the death of country music. It's something we've been working towards over the years. And I think with this album we will finally achieve it. Temple.
demolition, and in a world gone wrong, the death of country music rattles round the planet. So we light the flame and fan it deep into the night, where the city casts its shadow. We leave the straight and narrow.
Two years ago, John Langford published a remarkable collection of paintings and etchings he'd made. They were portraits of old country music stars based on vintage publicity stills. Paintings of photographs, he called them. The stiff smiles that great artists like Hank Williams, Johnny Cash, Lefty Frizzell, and others plastered on their faces to help sell records were rendered by Langford as something like death masks, the public faces they had to put on in between living the hard lives they and their audiences experienced. The book I just referred to is called Nashville Radio, Art, Words, and Music, and it's well worth seeking out for the way it captures the Waco brothers' love of American music that stirs what Langford calls in his book, quote, our alienated, drunk, commie souls. It's that dark yet exuberant tone that is also released to roam the country, wreaking jubilant havoc on the Waco Express.
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed the Waco Brothers CD, Waco Express, Live and Kickin' at Schubert's Tavern. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. This is NPR, National Public Radio.